From WBUR Boston, this is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. In 1998, Amartya Sen won the Nobel Prize in Economics for his work on welfare economics and the causes of famine. Tonight, we'll hear his views on globalization and the future of development in a post-9/11 world. First, we turn to Washington, where a strong and unexpected pro-Israel voice is making itself heard on Capitol Hill and on cable TV. Christian conservative leaders are rallying the faithful to push the U.S. to stand uncritically behind Israel. Gail Shattuck covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. Earlier, I asked her what was at stake for the Christian right in the Mideast.
They include groups like the Christian Coalition, as well as Christian broadcasters, a lot of talk show hosts. There was a big rally in Washington yesterday, Monday. Janet Parshall was there, who's a talk show host with National Christian Radio, and really, of all the speakers, was one of the most strongly supportive of the Israeli position that spoke there. She was saying things like, we will never give up the Golan, we will never divide Jerusalem, and we will call Yasser Arafat for what he is, a terrorist. But the use of we is interesting, you know, for someone who's in a small town USA to identify in such a direct way. I think it really started in the late 80s, early 90s with a movement among Christian fundamentalists themselves to get back to Jewish roots of Christianity, much more travel to Israel, much more learning of Hebrew, you know, in small towns in Oklahoma. And it's translated gradually into a much more solid expression of support for Israel.
My theology is very bad, but as I understand it, one of the reasons fundamentalists are interested in Israel is that they see it as the staging ground for Armageddon, that it's the battlefield that'll sort of end history with the second coming. And so they want to keep that battlefield, under control, where their interests will be protected in that fight.
Well, that actually does come out when you talk to folks. Ed McAteer, who is the founder of the Religious Roundtable, says that, when the battle is over, be sure that Jews will still be in this land because the enemies will be destroyed by the millions in a battle called Armageddon. So there is a sense among some people you talk to very clearly that peace movement makes no sense in this context.
That we're getting in the way of God's plan.
That's right. It's a very literal and very narrow reading of it. And I wouldn't say that all of those that I talk to share that view. For some, it's just a real sense of loyalty to the area that was the cradle of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
But there are others who take it much further than that and think that the whole notion of peace, a peace movement, is a destructive idea and is bound to fail because the Bible has dictated that this is going to end in a great battle.
Another irony is the theology of the Christian right and the biblical inerrancy that they profess. The theology is built around the crucifixion, and the biblical inerrancy is really about the Jews killed Christ, isn't it? I mean, to oversimplify the whole matter, the Gospels are very deceptive on that topic, are they not?
Well, I think that also was a view that you'd find much more expressed in the 50s and 60s than
mm-hmm.
you do now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I did a piece a few years back on where Hebrew was being taught because I thought that there was a very interesting revival going on among Jewish communities in the teaching of Hebrew. And I kept coming up with these places, tiny towns in Oklahoma,
mm-hmm.
where Hebrew was being taught
mm-hmm.
in the public schools,
mm-hmm.
thinking, what is this all about? And
mm-hmm.
when I called them, these were fundamentalist Christian school boards
mm-hmm.
who felt that, you know, a trip to Israel, learning that language, was a very important part of religious education. And I think that's a real change from the kind of Christ-killing
yes,
cartoon
yes, yes.
That we've always associated, or many people have associated with this group.
And what about the pressure this group exerts on President Bush? Gary Bauer, the former presidential candidate, was saying that he has allies all through the White House and that the Christian movement gets Bush's attention with its criticism, really, of Secretary Powell's mission.
Well, that certainly is true. That is the I've talked to people who claimed much more support than Gary Bauer did in this piece. He said 2 million supporters who are pressing the White House hard. Now, of course, this is something that President Bush has learned from his father's experience, that you cross the Christian right at your peril. You're going to need them come election time. However, there was something very interesting in this rally yesterday. The Deputy Pentagon Secretary Paul Wolfowitz spoke on behalf of President Bush, he said, and he was the only one in this rally that lasted for hours that used the phrase innocent Palestinians. He was booed for it. But he said, innocent Palestinians are suffering and dying in great numbers as well. It's critical that we recognize and acknowledge that fact. Now, that was a very interesting statement. And I think it suggests that this administration, certainly at this time, when the Secretary Powell is still very involved in the peace movement, is not going to ally itself 1,000% where the Christian right wants them to be.
Yes, that the United States has broader interests, as someone quoted in the New York Times, Deborah Wasserman of the Israel Policy Forum, says that America has two roles, to be a great friend of Israel and a mediator in
That's
the Middle
right.
East for Israel, precisely to try to make peace.
You know, it's interesting. I just came back off of Capitol Hill, and both Senators Lott and Daschle were making a point of saying that they were not going to allow any kind of resolution onto the floor, and there were quite a few just waiting to leap out and be voted on that will either condemn the Palestinians or wholeheartedly support Israel because they don't want to disrupt in any way the chances of this peace mission.
You know, in some ways, the alliance between Israel and the Christian right makes sense, especially with the religious parties in Israel, given that in American voting now, the more church-going you are, whether Jewish or Christian, the more likely you are to be a conservative.
Yes. It's going to be very interesting to watch how this develops.
Gail Shattuck is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. Amartya Sen grew up in Bengal. He remembers the Great Famine of 1943. His grandfather gave him a small cigarette tin to fill with rice to give to famine victims, one tinful per person. That experience has helped to inform a lifetime of inquiry that led to a Nobel Prize in economics for his work in increasing world understanding of poverty, inequity, and famine. Tonight, we're asking Professor Sen, who's been called the Mother Teresa of economics in his native India, to shed light on the direction of globalization in the world today. Is globalization a new form of Western imperialism based on the computer, or is there a more equal exchange to be had between East and West? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me tonight in the studio is Amartya Sen. He's Master at Trinity College in Cambridge, England, and Lamont University Professor Emeritus of Economics and Philosophy at Harvard University. Welcome, Professor Sen.
Thank you.
It's an honor to have you with us. Also with us tonight is On Point's news analyst Juliet Kayyem, head of the Domestic Preparedness Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and a former attorney with the U.S. Justice Department. Welcome, Juliet.
Thank you, Jack.
Great to have you with us. Professor Sen, you write in a very provocative article in the American Prospect magazine. You write, globalization is not a new Western curse. It is neither new nor Western, nor indeed a curse. Can you amplify that provocative statement?
Well, it's not new in the sense that increasing contact between different parts of the world have been going on for a long, long time. And quite a lot of it away from the West. And just to give an example, if you look at one of the major events of science and technology advance, in the 9th century, the first printed book in the world appears. It's printed in China. What book is it? It's a Chinese translation of a Sanskrit book. Done by whom? By half Turk, half Indian translator. His father traveled from India to East Turkmenistan and married a local woman, produced a child. Child went to China, translated this book from Sanskrit into Chinese, and in around 400 AD, And another few centuries later, that was the first book that was printed. Now, this is a marvelously globalized event, but it's neither new. It happened more than 1,000 years ago, nor Western. It's happening involving many countries, Turkey, China, India, but the West isn't there. And, of course, it's also a major advance. And those, so coming to the last point, why it's not a curse, I think the history of world civilization owes to global contact, learning from each other, and exchanging views, knowledge, and commodities and people with each other.
Indeed, you point out that this, you could see this, the current wave of globalization, as the second wave. The first, in the world of about 1,000 A.D., went from east to west.
Well, yes, I wouldn't say just two, but it is a continuous movement. Mm-hmm, but you're right that if there is a kind of reversal of current, that if you look at 1000 AD, that's the beginning of the last millennium rather than the end, which we have just passed, then you, if you were looking for science and technology, you know, printing, paper, iron chain, bridge, clock, compass, all these are known in China, but hardly anywhere else. If you're looking at the at mathematics, the decimal system, which emerged in India around between second to 6th century AD, had moved through the Arab world into Europe. The Arabs were working on a variety of mathematical problems, which were being picked up by the Western movements in the 11th century, Gerardo of Cremona, for example, and others. And these are movements coming from east to the west. And you find, I mean, you see remnant of it when a modern mathematician sitting in MIT or BU or Harvard sits down and does an algorithm. He may not remember that, he may not be aware that he is commemorating the name of Al-Khwarizmi, a 9th century Iranian mathematician who wrote in Arabic and whose book, Al-Jabr, is also the origin of the word algebra. Mm. So I think there's a kind of movement in both directions. Mm-hmm. It isn't so much that they're two clear-cut phases. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's just that movements have gone in both directions. Mm-hmm. And somehow in the modern world, mainly because of Renaissance and then the European Enlightenment, which are great achievements for the world, mm-hmm. and then the Industrial Revolution, since that put the West so far ahead that somehow that earlier history seemed to have disappeared. Mm-hmm. And there have been a reconstruction of it several millennia of the past on the basis of the last 300 or 400 years. And I think that's a mistake. We have to recognize how much the glory of globalization is a glory of the world.
We all share in it, Judith.
Yes.
The cultures.
I mean, I wonder why then has globalization gotten such a bad name? I mean, part of it may be that there are aspects or there are curses to this. And one is clearly the globalized arms trade that to a certain extent, you know, let's say the West export of militia and arms have helped and aided to destabilize continents, Africa, for example. But globalization does have, to a certain extent, a curse or a bad name. And to what extent is the West responsible for that, or is it just bad PR on the, you know, pro-globalization?
No, I think it's not bad PR. And Juliet, you're absolutely right to focus in on that. And let's begin with the arms trade. I mean, leaders of the G8 countries were, with some justice, complaining about the anti-globalization protesters and they're being irresponsible. They were overlooking at the same time the fact that 87% of the armaments exported in the world are exported by the G8 countries. 81% are exported by the 5 permanent members of the Security Council. So the world establishment is thoroughly entrenched in this business, and which, as you rightly say, plays a major part in destabilizing the world, just as in earlier in the 60s and 70s and 80s, the Cold War, which was fought on the continent of Africa, which led to any military overthrow being supported immediately by the United States if it was anti-Soviet, or by the Soviet Union if it was pro-Soviet and anti-US. And so in a sense, in the calamity that emerged in Africa, the West had a major role.
We'll be back soon. We're talking with Amartya Sen about globalism, about his cosmopolitan view of it. You can reach us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. Excuse me.
Boston University. This is
Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking with Amartya Sen, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, author most recently of Development as Freedom, about globalism this hour. Call us with your questions at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Professor Sen, before the break, we were talking about the arms trade.
Yes. Well, you see, that's when Juliet asked
an aspect,
the question.
A dark aspect of globalization.
And the other dark aspect, to which I think Juliet also hinted, is the sense of injustice and inequality in the world that we have today. And, you know, it's certainly true that the globalization in the contemporary form with the expansion of markets have created a lot of wealth. But many countries have not been in a position to join in that, sometimes because of internal problems and faults of their own, but sometimes also the opportunities for joining have been very limited. I mean, it's very hard to join a globalized market economy if you're bothered by, you know, disease and mm-hmm. illiteracy mm-hmm. and lack of credit and, you know, and no way you can enter a market economy without any kind of preparedness. So I think what Juliet's question is, why does globalization have a bad name, quite aside from the fact that there are these arms trade and inequalities and asymmetries of power, which are very destabilizing for the world. There is also the issue that the benefits of the marvelous benefits of globalized market economy have been very unequally shared. Mm-hmm. And that requires both positive, affirmative efforts to make it possible for the poorer countries to join in that fray, but also requires certain more sort of institutional reform. For example, one of the things that causes a lot of ire is the existing state of intellectual property rights and the patent rights. There may be medicine available for AIDS, can be produced extremely easily and cheaply, but they couldn't be sold there because of the royalties involved. Mm-hmm. And that's very counterproductive. Also, the market economy doesn't give enough incentive to develop those things which are really most importantly needed, namely single-use vaccines, which
yes.
might be of
yes.
important. So I think in many ways we have to both celebrate what the market economy can achieve mm-hmm. and also see that it required many institutional changes and indeed many other institutions to supplement what the market economy can do.
Mm-hmm. And this partly gets to your idea of what freedom is, doesn't it?
That's right.
You understand freedom is not just negative freedom, yeah. the government not telling us what to do, but is positive freedom. Can you explain that distinction? This is the land, of course, of doing as one likes, of negative liberty.
Yeah.
But you've got a richer understanding of positive.
Well, I think it's an extension of that understanding. I think the government not commanding you to do certain things which you don't want to do is a very important part mm-hmm. of one's mm-hmm. liberty, certainly. But you know, the people when people celebrated great liberties in the world. I mean, even in the French Revolution or in the great even such things as the Manchester Liberals celebrating in the Liberty Hall the importance of liberty. They were not thinking only of not being restrained. They also thought that they had a vision of society when people would be actually free to do things that they value doing. But that requires a lot of supportive action. Adam Smith, who was a great guru in many ways of the market economy, spent a lot of time discussing why it's absolutely essential for the state to do many essential things, including basic education, including certain things about healthcare. And there are also occasions he mentions that, you know, government interference is particularly bad because it tends to work out in the interests of the rich. Mm-hmm. And in fact, at one stage, he even goes to the extent of saying government intervention in the interest of poor almost always good. Mm. And government interference in the interest of rich, which alas is the case most of the time, is almost always bad. So I think, you know, I'm not trying to introduce mm-hmm. something.
Sure.
It is a thought which has occurred again and again. Mm-hmm. I can cite Indian mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. sources and Greek sources like Aristotle. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Adam Smith, John Stuart Mill. I mean, I think I would claim not originality, sure. but being in a long run tradition.
Yes, indeed. Let's take a call. Dan is on the line. Hello.
Hi, Professor Sen. It's good to hear you.
Hi. Yeah.
I have followed you a bit, and I read interviews with you, so I'm very pleased to speak with you. But I do have a question. on globalism and globalization, the first thing I'd say is that there's sort of two phenomena, it seems like. No one in the anti-globalization ranks is particularly against cross-fertilization between peoples and between cultures. But it seems to me that what they are critical of is which you mentioned before, is increasing inequality and greater wealth for wealthy people. And,
yes,
indeed.
But my question is regarding the creation of wealth itself. Isn't it true that in the last 20 years, which is, I guess, considered the globalized period, that growth rates worldwide have been lower than those after World War II up to, say, the early 70s when the Bretton Woods system started to break down?
Let's get Professor Sen's response.
Okay, I'll have to take that.
Well,
thank you,
I think you're right that there was a period of very high growth rate, but that, of course, continued to the 80s, actually. You see, the oddity is now, you are absolutely right, Dan, to emphasize that it is not anti-globalization. Often what goes by the name anti-globalization is not like, there are lots of things like that. India, my country, is called after the river Indus, which happens to flow entirely to Pakistan now. And nevertheless, India has retained that name. So we mustn't attach importance to exact wording, and you are absolutely right to look at the content. And growth rate, to some extent, certainly at this moment, has come down. But if you looked at the relative rates of growth, you find this oddity that some of the fastest growing economies are poor, and some of the worst performers are also very poor. For example, China had a record of growing faster. India, too, is growing fairly fast now. China about 8-10%, India about 6-7%. And where you have some countries in Africa where actually instead of expansion there have been a contraction. And so you have to look at the varieties of experiences there, and why is it that some cases they expand? And here, for example, what is often overlooked, that in the Chinese rapid expansion after the economic reform, they were to a great extent riding on the solid foundation in the pre-reform period, in fact, mm-hmm. in the Maoist period, when basic education was expanded, basic health care was expanded. So, in fact, that wasn't why Mao did it, mm-hmm. but there is no question that the pre-market reform period did a lot of things which actually helped the market reform. Mm-hmm. So one has to take an open mind and see in what way each country can perform better and what kind of a world order we can have. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that anti-globalization, quote-unquote, protesters are asking that question, and if you go by those questions, those themes, I think there's a lot to learn from them, mm-hmm. rather than the slogans that you see on their placards,
sure.
because those are a tremendously oversimplified view of what's going on.
Sure.
You know, before September 11th, especially with the Seattle incident here with the WTO, this
right.
is, you know, the anti-globalizers, I guess, were our terrorists. That, in fact, in the language of the discourse of politics, that's who we were calling terrorists after the violence of Seattle. Of course, since September 11th, we can no longer do that. But the globalization debate has been impacted by September 11th to a large extent, and you wrote about this a little bit in the New York Times.
Yes.
That in a world a political world where we are identifying with this Sam Huntington clash of civilizations, this idea of us and them, or even using the language of our politicians, us versus the cave dwellers, which is, you know, the desert dwellers,
yeah.
that the forces for globalization and good forms of globalization that you represent are somewhat being silenced or undermined by this embracing of the clash of civilizations, that it's us versus them, and of course, you know, the uber nationalism that is such a part of it.
I agree with that. Because, you know, I think part of the thing that's happened is that the identities have got defined in a very arbitrary way by people, sometimes by themselves,
right.
Led by, for example, fundamentalist movement. They say, look, you have no identity mm-hmm. other than being, say, Islamic or whatever it is. And then that becomes a big thing. And on the other hand, sometimes identities are imposed by others. And here, I think, the kind of work that classify civilizations into Western, Arabic, Chinese, Hindu, and so on, it actually does do a lot of disservice, partly because of what we were discussing earlier, there have been a lot of interconnections. but also because you can't classify people like that. We have many other identities. We have our interest in politics. We have our profession. We have interest in whether we like music, what kind of food, and so on, all kinds of things. And if we look at that, there's a kind of imposition of identity. You forget everything. There's a lovely remark of Peter Sellers, where he was being interviewed, where he said that there used to be a me, but I had it surgically removed. Now, actually, what often the surgical removal is done by others. And you end up in a situation, and that's the tragedy, which relates to the terrorist thing. When an Arabic activist today, an Arab activist or a Muslim activist, is resisting inequality as they see it in the world, the recollection of the past is now concentrated very often on the Quran and the Sharia and so on, rather than the history of mathematics, the history of science, which is also part of the Arab heritage. Even when I was hearing about the Washington, what happened today, about the Christian thing, just consider the Crusades. When the Crusades occurred, one of the big battles were between Richard the Lionheart on the Christian side and Emperor Saladin on the Muslim side. It's interesting that Maimonides, who was a great Jewish philosopher, 12th century Jewish philosopher, when he found Spain intolerable and sought refuge, where did he seek? Not with Richard the Lionheart, but with Emperor Saladin. It's in Cairo that he found a tolerant home. So I think the world history has changed a lot, and we have to remember real history rather than concocted history.
So the history of the conquerors. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Historically, the greatest growth ever seen was in this nation after the Civil War. That growth took place under the auspices of what we would call managed trade, under tariffs, which protected local producers, under state subsidies of railroads and all other sorts of economic activity. And the other great boom of in growth period was in East Asian economies after the war, also managed trade, protectionism, government intervention. Yet today, the West says to the developing world, free trade. Take your barriers away. But it doesn't buy the goods of the, as an Oxfam study, you're on the board of Oxfam, as an Oxfam study points out, we don't buy the goods from the third world. What we think of as globalization is buying Canadian goods or European, but very few from the developing world. So isn't there a tremendous hypocrisy? Have we kicked away the ladder of development for the poor?
Well, I think those who take that position certainly are taking, first of all, an erroneous position, and there are elements of hypocrisy in it. You use the word, I endorse it. But I think it's important to recognize that there's a lot of voices in the West, of course, differ from that. I mean, even Oxfam's Book of Trade, on which I wrote a foreword, in fact, in a sense, has a Western voice. I mean, the NGOs provide a different voice. I think to some extent, even the leadership in the World Bank has to some extent moved. And if you look at Jim Wolfensohn's position, would not be different from the one which you were, was putting forward, learning what happened in East Asia, what happened in post-Civil War, United States, and so on. And I think it's to recognize that there are voices which are very restrictive, which are inconsistent also, as you point out, for the reason that they wouldn't buy the goods, but nor would they like to have a development there. While those voices are present, there are other voices. So the world is a very plural world. That's part of my concern, that, in any of these reductionist stories, clash of civilization, or just your nationality being only thing, or the world is between a clash between East and West, it's an even further reduced one, we tend to lose out all the interesting details, the differences that make the world so rich.
Yes.
And that richness, of course, applied to the West. I mean, here we're sitting in the West.
Yes.
And you are being skeptical of the Western view. Now you are Western. I've seen one.
Jack is a reluctant Westerner. So.
I'm Jack Beattie. This is On Point. Let's take a call. Paul is calling from Providence. Hello.
Hi there.
Welcome.
Thanks a lot.
We're waiting for your statement, Paul.
Okay. Well, I've been at protests in Washington, D.C. and New York, but I don't call myself an anti-globalization protester by any means. I think of myself as a global democracy advocate. And I guess my question on that point is, how can societies choose to pursue particular capabilities when the only democratic decision-making going on around the world is constantly being undermined by the different international groups that regulate trade? I mean, for instance, we have NAFTA, which allows corporations to sue the United States government if they lose money based on rules that have been decided by Congress under very democratic means. So is there any way to get around this? I'm a big fan of Sen's work and of his ideas that we need, that societies should pursue capabilities as a means of economic development. But how are we going to choose as different societies to pursue these different capabilities,
Paul,
if we don't have any institutions?
Paul, thank you. Thank you for that. Globalization versus democratization.
Well, I don't think it's versus, really. I think Paul is absolutely right to emphasize these issues. Democracy is a very important ingredient of good living, and indeed an important ingredient of global living today. I mean, one thing we have learned is that democracy is the one form of society in which individuals can flourish. Now, given that fact, to emphasize the need for global democracy, which means on one side democracy in each country, also being able to hear each other's voices. I mean, when we were talking, when prompted by Juliet, when I went into the arms trade question, the fact that 87% of the arms trade and arms exporters should be the G8 countries, of 81% the five permanent members of the Security Council, indicates a level of inequality which is, I think, anti-democratic too. So I think democracy is the thing to emphasize, but it is a part of a just global order. I think that's the way to look at it. And I think, Paul, you raised a question about trade agreement and NAFTA and so on. We can debate to what extent they help and to what extent they hinder. But I think the biggest, of course, thing is the fact that quite often countries have not had the opportunity to determine their own democratic future. And I was going on to the fact the history of it is so incredible that, I mean, first when I went to Africa in the early 60s, it seemed like a continent ready to get into a democratic future. And then one by one, military dictatorships came, supported by the Soviet Union or the United States, and what began as the promise of a democratic continent ended up just full of tin pot dictators, with gone the health service, gone the education service, gone the media, and so on. So I think we have to recreate that across the world, and that's extraordinarily important. And I'm very glad you raised that question, Paul.
Thank you, Paul. We're talking with Amartya Sen about globalism this hour. You can reach us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beattie. This is On Point.
Boston University, this is W.
I'm Jack Beattie. This is On Point. We're talking with Amartya Sen, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, about globalization and its discontents this hour. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Professor Sen, when the Swedish Academy of Sciences awarded you the Nobel Prize, they noted that you had, quote, restored an ethical dimension to the discussion of vital economic problems. Have you also not restored a missing language to economics? That is, economics began, and as you know much better than I, with Adam Smith, and who was a moral philosopher in the first instance. But as it became mathematicized in the 20th century, it seems to have lost its connection with values and also with the view of economic activity as being more important than just itself, that is, having a human end. Have you tried? Is this part of your contribution to have?
Well, I'm not sure of that. That is, you know, it's very kind of you to refer to the rather positive statement that the Nobel Committee made. I don't know that. I mean, there are two problems here. I don't really think that mathematics is the real issue here. I mean, actually, as it happened, quite a lot of my work. In fact, the main ones cited for the Nobel citation are all mathematical work and social choice theory. It's really, in fact, it is mainly about welfare economic and social choice theory, which is the subject that was started by Kenneth Arrow in its modern form, and in earlier form in 18th century by French mathematicians who were also very involved with the French Revolution, like Condorcet, who started. So in some ways, mathematics and human concern about the nature of society have been linked up. Mm-hmm. There are different kinds of mathematics. I don't think that's where the problem is. Mm-hmm. Now, the ethical thing is that the methodologically, the impact of positivism as a philosophy was very strong in economics, beginning with the 1930s, so that it somehow economists were made to feel that they should be a little ashamed of doing soft-headed stuff like, good and bad, rather than what causes what. And I think there was that attitude. But there were a lot of exceptions to it, too. I wouldn't claim that in any way I was departing tremendously. I think I spent a lot more time, perhaps, on that than on other things. But the important question that the ethicists among the economists like Adam Smith, John Stuart Mill, Karl Marx, a lot of others I can think of, Edgeworth, Waldorf, Wicksell, certainly, raised, remain in economics, and people address them. I mean, some of the great economists of, Paul Samuelson, Kenneth Arrow, John Hicks, they were all concerned with welfare, they were concerned with these issues. I don't think there was a real departure on that, but I was pleased that the social choice theory, on which I spent a lot of my time, and it's really concerned with the issue that a society consists of many individuals, they have different views. What can we mean by saying society is better off? Or what we mean by saying society wants this? Is it majority? How do you deal with minority rights, etc.? So these were questions of great importance to me, and I think they are of great importance in general. So I was very pleased that the Nobel Committee picked that up. They actually added also a bit on the famine, etc., at the end. But that was a kind of tail piece. By the way, you began by mentioning about Mother Teresa. I have to say that I find that comparison very upsetting because it's very upsetting from both points of view. Because first of all, Mother Teresa really was a person of impeccable, moral sacrifice. I've never sacrificed very much at all in my life, led a perfectly good life. And she's made great sacrifices. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I've sort of, worked hard, burned the midnight candle and saying that all this hard work trying to solve these problems, that's all just good ethics. I resist that because there's a lot of hard work that goes into it of a different kind, which is really concerned with science.
Yes.
Seeing as a social science. So I think in some ways I don't acknowledge that connection, primarily because I think it's disrespectful to Mother Teresa, for whom I have a great respect.
That's journalism speak, I'm afraid. Fred is on the line. Welcome.
Hello.
Yes, welcome.
Yeah, I have a question for you. There's a comment also, I think, about globalization. My concern is the way that the big companies in globalization are becoming more power and destroying environment. They don't care about human being values. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And also, with globalization, the difference between poor and rich is becoming more deeply.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? Because today, rich run big companies, they run big business,
mm-hmm.
they go all over the world, they use people what they want, even they destroy, they never repair, and the poor are becoming more poor. That's the consequence of globalization.
Mm.
I think that globalization needs to be fixed, needs to be, it's like they have to learn really what globalization, where it can take us, because it can take us to dangerous that direction and destroy the world.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Fred. The role of corporations in globalization, as you know, the globalization protesters, and not them alone, say that globalization is about banks and big corporations primarily. They write the rules through the World Bank and the IMF, and that the poor are are sort of sacrificed to these corporate-driven globalization?
Well, I think one has to analyze the contribution that corporations make as well as the hindrances they make. Mm-hmm. I think it's very hard to think of a contemporary, you know, technology and large-scale production without there being corporation. So I think in some ways one has to be careful not shooting oneself in the foot in the context of trying to get a more just world, which mm-hmm. is extremely important. But I think what one has to do is to identify which way the corporations do harm. For example, just to give an example, George Soros has a wonderful argument in his book called The Open Society that one of the ways the corporations have a bad effect, that sometimes a big corporation in a small country can actually subvert the direction of investment of the government. Instead of it being concerned with basic education, tends to be concerned with creating skill which could be used by the corporation. Instead of being concerned with basic healthcare, mm-hmm. they're concerned with the safety of the managerial classes or the elite workers who work in this corporation. And therefore, there is a kind of impact which one ought to look at. So I think what the question that Fred is raising, I mean, both the questions are important. I think the effects of corporation, and we have to see what these evil effects are. I don't think you're going to get a world in which there are no corporations. That's a kind of the guild socialist world. They seem more plausible at the beginning of 20th century than they seem now. But it's a question of which way they could be to be restrained and which way their functioning operates in the interest of everyone. And Fred is also right to concern about the rich and the poor, not just in the space of incomes, mm-hmm. but healthcare, basic mm-hmm. education, and everything. And I think if we concentrate on inequality and we concentrate on expanding the freedoms that the poorest and the least privileged get in the world, we need a kind of institutional structure bearing in mind its feasibility and its compatibility of mm-hmm. contemporary technology. And that's really the direction to go. And I would say, just as in the case of anti-globalization protesters, take the themes, but not necessarily the thesis. Mm-hmm. Here, too, I would mm-hmm. say take the theme and run with it, because mm-hmm. that's very important.
Mm-hmm. Professor Sen, as you make clear, you are not a saint, nor are you a prophet, but I did want to ask you about the future. It seems both in the West and certainly not in the West, there is probably a feeling of unease right now or uncertainty, both because of a continuing conflicts, both big ones between the U.S. and certain areas of the world and small ones, civil wars throughout the globe. And at the risk of sounding too personal, I sort of wonder, you know, because your work is very optimistic in many ways. You sort of promote sort of the good things and sort of what could happen if we adopt something. But, you know, so what keeps you up at night? What makes you nervous about the future? And what, you know, how can we think about maybe trying to change that? Because there's a lot of uncertainty out there, both here, you know, you can feel it.
There's uncertainty and a lot of nastiness, too, actually.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, for example, as an Indian, I'm quite proud of India's secular history. Mm-hmm. I'm quite proud of its democracy. And yet when this ghastly thing happened in Gujarat,
right.
in which, to start with, of course, it was some Hindus coming back from Ayodhya who got killed by fire being set by a Muslim mob. But the dramatic reaction that came with the Muslims being attacked by basically Hindu thugs, right. and with the state government, Gujarat, doing extremely little. That makes me ashamed as well as make me very deeply pessimistic. Now, happily, it's been concentrated only on that 1/12 of the country and not in the rest. I mean, if I may boast my part of the country in West Bengal, they haven't had a thing like that for since independence. But it is. It keeps worrying. And similarly, when Hutus and Tutsis have the violence or what happened in Yugoslavia. So I think we have to be concerned about sectarian violence, the what is often wrongly described as identity battles. But, you know, these are not even traditional historical battles. These are modern battles invented by political groups. I think in the case of India, I think it's just as the Hindu fundamentalist parties is losing power. Every election they have had in the last 4 or 5 years, they have lost. So that in a sense, it's almost a kind of reaction against this in trying to make the communal issue come back into mm-hmm. the forefront. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of that. And I think it's not adequate just to believe in the power of reason, which I do, but actually to try to see that the power of reason is applied. I think I do have a belief in the humanity of people and our ability to use reason for humane causes. But, Juliet, you're absolutely right to serve as a critic and and remind me that it's not adequate to be optimistic. We have to work for it.
Astaire is on the line. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah. Welcome. Could you give us your comment, please?
Thank you. It's great to speak with Professor Sen.
I've been
a student of his for the last 20 years.
Thank you.
And yeah. I have a quick comment and a question about your argument about the positives of globalization, such as contributions to science, technology, and culture, all the good things that have now been well and truly been appropriated by the West. And we have the bad side of globalization, like the arms trade, conflicts, which generate human suffering, increasing numbers of asylum seekers and refugees, whom Western governments don't really like to hear of anymore.
Sure.
And that's not being dealt with by the West, that appropriates the good side of globalization and not the bad.
I'm sorry, we're up against time. Can you frame your question for us, Astaire, please?
Do you see, what is there hope in your view on the horizon that this situation will be halted, if not reversed?
I have a hope, yes, as Juliet rightly diagnosed, I'm a hopeful person. But, you know, I think part of the answer relates to the question that Paul raised and in the context of global democracy. Because when you point out there's a lot of things happen which are bad, even coming from the West. But, of course, most of the Western countries are democratic countries. And so what is needed is also resisting these things, I think. And I'm a great believer in public discussion and bringing things into the public domain. I think in order to change the arms trade situation, we have to have much more discussion on that. In order to change the barbarity of the patent laws, we have to change that position too, recognize what a dreadful impact it has on the lives of people, with millions of people dying. So I think democracy, public participation, have to be the major ally of using reason for humane purposes. So as to have the objectives and the values that you and I share have to be pursued through our own efforts in collaboration with others. I think that's where democracy is really not only a value in itself, but it's also
problem solving.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly right. Would it be accurate to describe you in Gramsci's terms as a pessimist of the intellect, an optimist of the will?
Well, I think that's not a bad description. I don't remember the context in which Gramsci made that remark, but I think that's probably so.
Although you also say, intellectually, globalization is a hopeful development.
I agree with that.
And that isn't just a matter of the will.
No, I agree with that.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure to have you, Professor.
Thank you very much indeed.
Amartya Sen is the Nobel Prize-winning economist and the author of Development as Freedom. Juliet Kayyem is Executive Director of the Domestic Preparedness Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. To read Professor Sen's 10 theses on globalization, check on our website. The address is onpointradio.org. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our